Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Taksim Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week, meditation instructor Eric Weinberg continues our series on the history of the Karmapas with an examination of the life of the third Karmapa, Rangjung Dorje, entitled Aspiring to Accomplish Mahamudra. Eric shares accounts of important events in the third Karmapa's life and examines his legacy, which includes the writing of the Aspiration to Mahamudra prayer. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Taksim Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Well, good morning, everybody. Happy New Year. Thank you for coming. When Lama Kathy isn't here, Kathy Lama or Marcus Casey or I give talk, and we usually do it on framework of book that we're studying together, we're learning together. And it is learning together. Right now we're doing two books at the same time. And one of them is by Zemnitz Taisitu, which is kind of like the teachings of the Karmapas about what our nature, what our true nature is all about. Not our neuroses and who we think we are, but when we have those clear light moments, whenever we have them, and everybody gets a glimpse. And that book is about that. This one is actually about the history of our lineage and the people who have passed these teachings down to us. It's the history of the Karmapas. For me, this is like very inspiring. And it helps me on the path to see how great masters have been on the path, because it's not how I think it is. Today we're at the point of talking about the third Karmapa, Rangjung Dorje. The last talk was about the second Karmapa, Karmapakshi. And it's really interesting to understand that you'll see this, it's not 100% right, but you'll see this, that usually there's a Karmapa that has a kind of wild, great, important breakthrough realizations, and they just travel and do stuff. And then the next one also has breakthrough realizations, but they write. And this one kind of wrote down so it could be passed on to us what the realizations were. Because the whole idea is that we all have the same nature and we all get to be Buddha. I read a story about the guy who's considered to be the wildest, craziest yogi in the history of Tibet. He was a total, in some people's eyes, a total ne'er-do-well, and yet he was obviously a great yogi. And his name was Trinley Khunle. He's a Drukpa, which is our cousins, one of the Marpa Kagyu lineages. And it's said that he'd wander around and just do all these wild things. And one time he was there and he went to Lhasa, where the big Jowo Buddha is. And this Buddha is like the biggest, holiest, oldest, most full of relics, big energy Buddhas in the world, you know, statues. And people do pilgrimages to that and meditate there and circumnambulate it. And it's really, it's a thing. And he shows up all in rags, and he looks up at it like doesn't even do prostration. Some people prostrate all the way from their homes all the way to Lhasa. It can take them years instead of just walking. You know, they'll do prostrations all the way. This big devotional thing. Not him. He just kind of walks in, looks up at him like, hi, how you doing? And people are pretty scandalized by that. And he spends a minute just considering the Jewel Buddha. And then he says something like, hey, I remember you. You and I, we were together. And he said, you were diligent. I, on the other hand, have been as lazy as I could possibly be. So there's you, and you're enlightened, and here am I just kind of wandering around. And then he did prostrations, and then he sat, and he practiced. And it said that there was great blessing, because he was actually a great yogi. The third Karmapa story is kind of interesting because what you can see, begin to see unfold, is that he actually embodies the qualities of those in the lineage. He's like the 11th or the 12th, I forget, in the lineage since Tilopa. And you can see how the qualities and the activities happened in his life that happened in the second Karmapa's life, that happened in the first Karmapa's life, but they keep evolving and growing and changing. And this has to do with the commitment and the diligence that these beings have. They're enlightened beings. They're living Buddhas. We have one right now, and it's pretty amazing to see him, if you ever get to see him. And it's not that you get goosebumps necessarily, although you probably will. And it's not that the hairs on the back of your neck will stand on end, but they might. And it's not that, you know, he like glows in the dark. You look at his activity, and he's not just out there building monasteries. This one built a lot of monasteries for, in order to help us and help the people that followed him. It's not just that he's giving teachings. He writes a lot. There are a lot of books by the 17th Karmapa. Interestingly, like I said, the 16th Karmapa was a great siddha. He was a great yogi, but he didn't write a lot. This is another one of those rhythms. It's not just that. He's expanded his activity. His biggest concern is to literally save the planet. I mean, he's concerned with all of us individually, but his ability and his concern and his activity is just embracing the world with such incredible compassion. So where we're at right now with the third Karmapa is to engage with the third incarnation of the Karmapas and to see where he was at. For me, it's really, really interesting. It reminds me, his life reminds me of a story by Rabbi Twersky. Have you ever heard of Rabbi Twersky? Famous rabbi. Somebody asked him about growth, and he said, well, you got to think about a lobster. How does a lobster grow? And he says, lobsters are born, and they're soft and squishy, and they grow a hard shell. And they take on nutrients, and they swim around and get stronger, and pretty soon the shell is a little bit too small and confining, and it's very hard, and it doesn't expand. And so they crawl under a rock, and their shell, they get out of their shell, they leave their shell behind, and they're very soft and squishy and vulnerable to all the elements and everything like that. And they take on more nutrients, and they grow more and more, and they grow a new shell. And then they go out and do their lobster thing, and they grow more and more, and pretty soon that shell becomes confining. And when it becomes too confining, and the pain of being too confined by their shell gets to be too great, they go find another rock, and they crawl under another rock, and they lose that shell and continue the process. I would submit to you that the example of this particular Karmapa is much like that. You'll see as I kind of relate the story. Because he had incredible activity. He got more, he only lived 56 years, 55 years, but he got more done in 55 or 56 years than I certainly did in 55 or 56 years. And yet, after every period of big activity, he'd go find a sacred space, a cave, somewhere to retreat. And he did retreat, which was kind of letting go of that identity. Whatever it is that he was holding on to, whatever it is that his followers were projecting on him, and he grew more, and he studied more, and he practiced more, and he came out a little bit more developed and with a new shell. And this rhythm continued throughout his life. I think the most important thing about studying holy people like this is to understand that we're exactly like them. It's not like he was a special kind of human being or some Martian plonked him down on Earth for our benefit, although there are people who say that, you know, the really special people aren't really humans. Buddhism doesn't believe that at all. What those that have gone down this path really far always say is that we're the same that way. We all have this potential for waking up. We have the potential for great warmth, great kindness, great insight, and a limitless capacity for knowledge. So first and foremost, it should be inspiration. One of the things that the third Karmapa taught, this will be the last part of my intro for him, is that he taught clearly on some of the most difficult philosophical and epistemological issues in Buddhism, like emptiness and so on, what the middle way is all about. He got that stuff from all the different angles. And at the end, after teaching us how to practice so we could realize it for ourselves, which is to say realize enlightenment for ourselves, he flatly says, everything depends on blessing. And he says later in that same prayer that devotion makes blessings roar. In other words, the descent of blessing comes from a certain way of being in love with not just the person of the teacher, but in love with your own potential, your own Buddha nature. And that's what causes this extraordinary kind of life to unfold. Anything else is going to be impermanent because it's grabby. Even if we're grabbing after something that is good on the face of it, it's still grabby, and we're still going to have to let go. We'll still have to find a cave. The shell's still going to have to go away. So in one sense, you're a Buddha. In the other sense, in order to become what you already are, it takes extraordinary humility. I had a thing that I like about devotion, because it's a hard word for Americans. We don't do devotion really good, most of us. So this is out of a book, and I can't tell you which one. I copied it, and I made it really big, and then I didn't write down on it which book I got this from, but I thought it was pretty good. It says, there are different levels of devotion. There is devotion that's admiration, devotion that is longing or yearning, devotion that is deep trust, and devotion that is irreversible, unshakable confidence. We progress through these different levels as our understanding and experience deepen. The intellectual understanding we have that is a result of study and reflection will never be more than admiration and longing. So we do. We all read a lot. We all study a lot. We all do stuff, and we really want that, and we really admire the Karmapas and all that. That's not the level of devotion that causes blessings to roar, though. As we gain direct personal experience, we can develop the devotion that is real trust and confidence. And that's why you stick with it and you practice every day and you make your practice as important as your study. They're both important. But don't say, oh, I like reading and getting all kinds of cool information, but I don't like practice. So you do what you like and you don't do what you don't like. They have to be together. They have to be. Or some of us prefer not to strain our brain and don't want to study anything, and we just want to sit on our cushion. And yeah, we need both together. So as we gain direct personal experience, which we get through the teachings, practice, the study, contemplation of them, the thinking about them, and meditation, which is meditation. So as we gain direct personal experience through those three things, we can develop devotion that is real trust and confidence. The final stage, unshakable or irreversible devotion, is only possible when we are totally free of doubt. And that's hard to imagine that we could be free of doubt, but it actually happens. Why? Because through this path of hearing the teachings, reflecting on the teachings, and practicing the teachings, you get your own direct experience. And your own direct experience, you're not going to doubt. It's going to be beyond what you think or make up, beyond what you see. The reason I wound up in Buddhism was I was actually a meditation instructor in different traditions, but I kind of ran out of room. I ran out of teaching. I was sort of making it up as I went along because there was nobody left to offer me what the next step was. And so doubt never cleared. I didn't know that it was this formulation at the time. I had no way of understanding that. But looking back, I could see that's what it was. And I had the good luck of feeling uncomfortable. My shell was a little too tight. So I crawled under a rock. And the nutrients that I got was Lama Kathy. And the rest has moved on from there. So in that spirit, usually we start, you know, all these talks with simply taking refuge, which I think is in so many ways one of the most important things we do every day, is to recognize that our real refuge isn't going to come from all the mundane experiences of our life just going right. Our refuge is going to come from actually directly engaging our own Buddha nature. So we take refuge in the Buddha, and we take refuge in the Dharma, which are the teachings, and help us remember that we're not what we think we are. And we take refuge in the Sangha, which is each other. All the holy beings in our lives that help remind us that we aren't what we think we are. I mean, it'll happen today for me, because I'll give this teaching and some of you will like it. And you'll tell me that. And I'll go sit in my car on the way home and I'll say to myself, oh, I should have said this and I should have said that and I could have done this better. Oh, I didn't engage them enough. You know, whatever. I'll be critical. We depend on each other to reflect to us and remind us who we really are. Because I don't know about you, but I am still in a state of benighted ignorance, and I forget who I am all the time. So in that sense, let's chant the refuge prayer in Tibetan together. If you know the prayer, please join with me. If you don't know the prayer, please just join on in your heart, realizing that you're taking refuge in the example of the Buddha and your own true nature, which are the same thing, the teachings and the enlightened beings all around you all the time. Sanje Judang Suki Chognam La Jangchu Pardu Dagni Kyab Suchi Dagi Jinso Gipe Sunam Gi Drola Pinchir Sanje Drupar Sho Sanje Judang Suki Chognam La Jangchu Pardu Dagni Kyab Suchi Daki Jinso Gipe Sunam Gi Drola Pinchir Sanje Drupar Sho Sanje Judang Soki Chognam La Jangchu Pardu Dagni Kyab Suchi Dagi Jinso Gipe Sunam Gi Rola Penchi Sanje Drupal Show. So, the third Karmapa, Rangjung Dorje. He was born in the year of the wood monkey. I love that. Which was 1284 in the Roman calendar. He was born in a place in Song province where in the 11th century, a great master named Padampa Sanjay had traveled and established a lineage, CJ lineage, which is the lineage that teaches what's called Chud practice, which is a very yogic practice of letting go of everything. His father was a guy named Tempa Chutpel, and he was a very sincere practitioner of this practice. When the second Karmapa was still alive, he had traveled through there, and he met this guy, and he told this guy, hey, we'll meet again, and I'm going to come live in your house, and you'll take care of me. And this guy was a little bit shocked by that, because at that time he was a wandering yogi, and he had nothing, and he certainly had no house. He didn't even have a yurt. He had no oxen. He had no nothing. But eventually he did settle down. And he got married, and his wife got pregnant. And after 9 months or whatever, she was up on the roof of the house, which is what Tibetans do. They always have like a roof garden in their construction. And she was there with her aunt and about to give birth. And as the sun set and the moon rose, she did. She gave birth. And the story goes that the birth was pain-free, which is kind of cool if you've been through birth before. I think that's a way of saying something about the compassion of enlightened beings, because that's often said about the birth of enlightened beings. But whether that's true or not, it also says that he sat up. This baby, newborn baby, sat up. He pointed at the moon. He said, "The moon has risen." I think that he was probably just went. That I kind of believe, but it was kind of important that he did something unusual because the aunt thought it was a bad omen. This part got written down, and I kind of believe it because, you know, we all have relatives around that think one thing or another when new babies come. Well, these people were very shamanic, and they believed in good and bad spirits and all that kind of jazz. And she thought, whoa, this is not a good omen. And the tradition was if there was a bad omen at a birth, you put ash in the baby's mouth. And it, yeah, I know, right? And that would prevent evil spirits somehow from having any kind of impact. And so it is said that for 3 years after birth, this baby was an ordinary child because of the interdependence of the aunt doing this like strange kind of ritual. And at that time, at the time of his birth, it's also noted that the lineage holder of the Karmakaju, a guy named Siddha or Gyempa, he's the one that Karmapakshi passed the lineage on to. It was his heart student. And he would be the guru of the next Karmapa and teach him the lineage. He saw some things. He saw Karmapakshi surrounded in light come to him in one of his meditations. And he had a feeling that that meant that the Karmapa had been reborn. So anyway, in the third year, this is kind of cool, the kid just out of the blue starts telling his parents, "I want you to make me a black hat." Now, I can remember actually telling my parents I wanted to make me this or that. I never wanted a black hat, but he was real specific about how he wanted it to be. And of course, it was the kind of the black hat that Karmapas wear. And after it was done, one day he was out playing with the kids, and he had them build him a throne out of dirt and grass. And he sat on the throne, and he gave them teachings, and he admonished them. He was apparently an aggressive little kid. He didn't like them, like, carrying on emotionally. He just would always say, "This is going to do you no good. If you think that what, you know, life's going to give you what you want, it's just going to lead you down the road of perdition. Just stop that. Wake up." And he gave him a teaching that was remembered to be something called Introducing the Three Kayas, which was something that I believe was part of Karmapakshi's main practice. And just out of the blue. I mean, the kid, 3-year-old, sitting up there on some mound of grass and teaching these other kids. My wife, Jeannie, said they used to play mass when they were kids, and somebody used to get to be priest and all that. I mean, it might have been something like that, except This was a little different because he was wearing his hat, sitting on the throne, teaching a particular thing. The kids were pretty freaked out, so they ran into the town and told their parents. And at that point, you know, his mom and dad realized, okay, that was weird at birth, and it was normal till now, but it's weird again. And so they took him to a famous temple in the area where there was a big statue of Padampa Sanjay, who was one of the great saints who came through and started that lineage there. And the kid said, it feels like a rainbow just went into my heart. So at five, they decided to take him. He wanted to be taken to where Siddha or Genpa was. And they were making the trip to his monastery. And the night before the, you know, traveling through the Himalayas takes a little while. It's not like if I leave today, I can be in L.A. by evening, or probably even early afternoon L.A. time. They couldn't do that back then. It was a long walk and over the mountains and so on. So the night before they were to arrive, Orjenpa had a dream that the previous Karmapa, his teacher, Karmapakshi, came to him and said, I'm coming tomorrow. And so he set up a throne for him. In Tibetan temples, you'll see this very often. There's a high throne for the head of the lineage to sit in and give teachings. There's one at KTD. Nobody sits there. Nobody sits there except Karmapa when he comes. Usually they have a photograph of him sitting up on this throne. But, you know, it's like Kempo Karthar Rinpoche doesn't go there. When His Eminence Taisitu, who is the guru of the current Karmapa, came, he didn't sit up there, only Karmapa. So this little kid who has been schooled in the manners of the monastery by his father, he walks through the back doors, marches right up, right past Orjenpa, doesn't even give him a hi, how you doing, crawls up on the throne and sits down. And Orjenpa says, you can't do that. He says, yes, I can. I'm Karmapa. And Orjenpa decides, well, I got to give him a little test. This is the tradition for reincarnate lamas, to give him a test. There are actually a lot of tests. They try to be pretty careful about this. So Orjenpa says, okay, if you're Karmapa, last time we saw each other, you gave me something to hold for you. What did you give me? And he said, oh, I gave you my hat, and I gave you the text of introducing the three kayas. And that was right. And there were some other tests along the way. And after that period passed, Karmapa got off the throne, came down, and did three prostrations in front of Orjenpa and said, you're my teacher in this lifetime. And so that began his first formal introduction. And he had about 13 more years. After 2 years of study with Orjenpa, he ended up taking novice vows. And then he had 11 years of study. And apparently he was a great student, voracious reader, good practitioner, and all that, really absorbed the stuff. And at 18, he took full ordination. Over the course of this 11 years and plus a few more, he apparently was so voracious, he studied with, they've counted 113 different lamas. He learned science stuff, epistemology, philosophy, astronomy, astrology. He created a system of astrology during that time that's still used. The moon calendar used in Serpu he created during this time, and so on and so forth. And so at 18, he took full ordination, and then he went on solitary retreat. It's that lobster thing. And he went to a really isolated place near Mount Everest. And when he came back, he wanted to study with more masters. He wasn't done yet. He wanted to master all the different schools of thought. So he kept going on the study track after his retreat until he was about 20. And he set out at that point to come. And the first thing he wanted to do was restore monasteries. He had become really interested in making sure that everybody had all the resources they needed to be able to practice well. And some of the monasteries, after 100 years or so, had fallen into some disrepair. So he came there, and there are three big monasteries in Kham. One's called Karmagun, and that, they said, represented his body, the Karmapa's body. And sure enough, there were a lot of practitioners there all the time. There's another one. I forgot the name of it. Oh, Kampo Nenang was the body. Karmagun was the speech. And then Serpu, which is famous as being the seat of the Karmapas, was considered a mind emanation of the Karmapas, the monastery itself. And that's where all the meditators were. So he went through all of there, restoring these monasteries, getting everybody up and running, practicing the way they should. And there was a lot of, distress in the region. Humans fight with each other. So he really spent a lot of his time doing counseling work. He put an end to a lot of conflicts. There were a lot of warlords and a lot of people who thought they owned stuff and other people shouldn't own it and all that kind of thing. At that point, he decided he's going to go back and study some more. But first, after all this work of restoring monasteries and pacifying warring factions, he decides to go to retreat again. And he goes to this place near Serpu Monastery called the Lotus Garuda Hermitage. And when he was there, this was something that was important to me. He was in deep meditation. And at this point, you know, there are different lineages in Tibet. So the oldest lineage is called the Nyingma lineage, which means old school. It's old school Buddhism. But it's also known for the practice that that's their core, which is Dzogchen. And while he was there, he got the complete transmission of Dzogchen in meditation by Vimala Mitra and Guru Rinpoche, Padmasambhava. They came to him in meditation and basically dissolved right into his heart. Now, a lot of us would say, that's a woo-woo thing. And all your meditation teachers would say, yeah, well, that's nice, but keep practicing. And you know what he did? He took it as something that had actually happened for sure, because he had direct experience. He had no doubt about that. But he didn't run around saying, okay, I'm a Dzogchen master now. He went out and found this guy named Kumaraja, who was the lineage holder of Dzogchen at the time, and he became one of his chief students. So we're talking about Karmapa here, an enlightened being who once again became a student. I think this is something that you'll see throughout all of them. they don't stop growing, even though they're enlightened. We don't get to stop growing either. I think there are only two real energies underneath all of this that you'll ever see. There's the wish to grow and the wish to benefit all beings without exception and remove their suffering. So he studied under this master, and he studied one of his classmates was Lonchenpa, who some of you may know him, some of you may not, but he is basically the fountainhead of the Nyingma tradition. Their whole practice is called the Longchen Nintik, which is the heart essence of Lonchenpa. And Karmapa developed something called the Karma Nintik, which is the heart essence of the Karmapas, which has now come down to us and is part of the traditional path of practice we use in order to achieve the highest meditations like Mahamudra. So that includes something you may have heard of called Nundro, or the preliminary practices. It comes originally from this. It's a gift to us, given so that we can have the same realization Karmapas have. How many of you guys have considered, I'm not asking who does it or doesn't do it, how many of you have considered doing Nundro? Think about it. I just want to share this with you particularly because as an encouragement, as knowing where this comes from. It's not just like a series of hoops where if you do all this stuff, you get a gold star in your forehead and you get to do new stuff. There's actually blessing attached to it. And through that blessing, you actually gain the skill and the ability and the stamina to be able to do Karma Nintink, the heart essence of the Karmapas, which is Mahamudra. So it's important. It's important to know, too, that Kumaraja was a lot like Talopa. He didn't ever have a home. He built monasteries and homes for everybody, took care of animals all the time, but he never had more than a windbreak up in the mountains. He never kept anything. He always moved. So Karmapa had to follow him around everywhere to get these teachings. It was this thing about the real, real necessity of letting go in order to realize that the stuff we hold on to isn't what's going to bring us happiness. You can't really prove it to yourself until you let it go and you realize you're okay, or it gets taken from you, which happens a lot in life, and you find out that you're okay. So anyway, there is this whole rhythm of getting teachings and going into retreat and getting teachings and going into retreat. And I won't go through the next three of those because you're getting the idea now. The next thing that happened, though, follows again with what happened with Karmapakshi. He got invited to Khan Balik, which is now called Beijing, by the Mongol emperors. If you remember, Karmapakshi was the guru to Kublai Khan when Marco Polo arrived and all of that. Well, this guy got invited back. They were having problems, basically. There was a lot of discord in the court. There was a lot of problems with the environment. And see, even the third Karmapa is concerned about the environment, not in the same kind of way this one is, but excuse me. But he got invited. It's a long drive. it's a long drive from Tibet up into Beijing. Well, they were walking along the way, and while he was going, he stops and gives teachings and blesses. It takes some time. And the first time out, they encountered bad weather. I mean, literally snowfall at a weird time of year that closed the passes, couldn't go, turned back. Waited another year, started again. And they were about a day out when, it was more than that. But they were a little ways out when the Karmapa realized that the Khan had passed. And he actually stopped the whole caravan, and they did funeral stuff. There's a bunch of traditional Tibetan meditations at the time of death, and Karmapas are the masters of that. And so he did that whole thing for this great Khan, and then went on to Beijing and met the six-year-old kid who was going to be the next Khan. It wasn't long before he realized that that Khan wasn't going to live long, and within 2 months he passed away. And another one was enthroned. It was a turbulent time because the Khans weren't seemingly able to do what a son of heaven is supposed to do. They were considered the son of heaven. So they should have been able to heal all the sick, control all the elements, you know. And meanwhile, they had really bad rains and floods, which wiped out a lot of stuff. And then it got really hot and dry, and there were famines. So that's why they wanted Karmapa there. And Karmapa stayed there and bestowed teachings on the next emperor. I'm looking for his name. Doesn't matter. It'll come to me. And established this new guy, and he did some things that actually helped the environment. There are all kinds of miracle stories in here that I'm not going through, but he had some abilities, some skills to work with the environment that seemed non-ordinary. To him, it seemed ordinary, but to us, it wouldn't seem ordinary. So after he did what he could, he decided to go back to Tibet. And he made frequent stops. One of the places that he stopped was this place called Wutaishan. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's good to look up Wutaishan. It's one of the most beautiful places in the world. It's in China. It has five very tall peaks. It's in a lot of Chinese brush paintings. And it's considered to be the abode of Manjushri. So he stopped there. And he did a small retreat, built a small monastery that's still there and is still a place of pilgrimage. When Kempo Kartha Rinpoche at 91 or 2 took a bunch of students to Tibet a few years ago, they actually journeyed to Wutaishan and made pilgrimage to this place. So that's kind of cool. Anyway, he came back, and he finally stayed in Karmagun Monastery with all the monks for a while, and then moved down to a cave that was part of the complex of Samye that Padmasambhava had built. And there he commissioned a whole set of the Buddhist scriptures, which is a big thing if you've ever seen it. It's like a whole wall of books, Tibetan-type books, and they're all woodblock prints. It was a big deal. And he blessed them all, and in the time of the blessings, he is said to have received the entire teaching in some direct way. In the meantime, he himself wrote 16 volumes, which was just a little bit compared to some other people. But I think given all the other stuff he was doing, it was a lot. And he presented them to Samye Monastery. And then he headed back to China because he'd been invited again by the Khan. When he was there, he gave this Khan a special long life elixir and did special long life practices so these Khans could stop dying. And it turned out this guy would be the last Khan in the Yuan dynasty. But he did live for an extraordinarily long time, like 80 years. While he was there at 55 years old, he realized he was going to die soon. And so he went into meditation, and like soon meant the next day. And he died in meditation. And after 7 days, his body remained in meditation. He was cremated in the traditional way, and the Khan did a remarkable job putting together everything for his teacher. They used the most sacred sandalwood they could find for the pyre and so on and so forth. The entourage was in total crazy. They were total crazy. You know, they were very attached to him, very dependent on him, and he just up and died on them at 55 or 56 years old, and it was a difficult thing. And that night, while everybody was going crazy, it's weird, his monks, the people who should have known better, were going crazy. That night, one of the ministers of the Khan was out, and the moon was brighter. It was a really bright full moon. And he looked up and he saw an exact image of the second or the third Karmapa in the moon. And he pointed up and he went and got everybody. And they realized that he was still there in that sense. They was going to stay with him. Now, what's interesting is the moon was the thing the baby was supposed to have pointed at, right? And the other thing is the moon is like the analogy for Mahamudra, which is the pith teaching of the Karmakaju lineage, the highest meditation teaching. And I can tell you, the first time I saw the current Karmapa at Karmatriyana Dharma Chakra monastery that he was visiting, he made us all cry because he said he knew what everybody was doing and he knew how hard we had worked and he knew how much we had given and how much we're doing for the benefit of beings, and that meant a lot to him. So what he said was, any night, and this goes for all of you because just being here, you're connected to Karmapa. You are. He said, anybody connected to me any night can look up at the moon and remember me, and I'll see you, and I'll send my blessings. So that was my own direct experience of the moon. And I can honestly tell you that while I don't see his perfect image in the moon all the time, I do look up at the moon a lot and ask for his blessings. And I'd encourage you to do that too, because everything depends on blessing, as this Karmapa said. So there's about 5 minutes left, so, and I did nothing to engage you except just tell this long story. But there's time for questions and answers. If you have them, they can be about anything. They don't have to be about the third Karmapa. I brought about another bunch of stuff that I was going to share with you. I want to refer you to, there's a famous prayer that he wrote and he gave, bestowed on us, called the Aspiration to Mahamudra. It is a complete teaching of the path. there are good commentaries online of this so that you can kind of unpack it for yourself. It's very pithy. But for me, it's a very special thing. Before I was even a Buddhist, when I was just interested in books and I'd buy books. There's a friend of mine here from New York, Devo, who knew me from way long time ago. There used to be this bookstore up by the University of Cincinnati that I go to, had new and used books. The first Dharma book I ever bought was called The Secret of the Supreme Siddhas, which was actually the Eighth Thai Sittu's commentary on this prayer. I read it and didn't understand what in the world I was reading. But it's funny how things like that circle back. I would just encourage you to go online and find, there are various translations, some translation of this prayer. And commentary, there's a good one by the third, Jamgon Kontrol, that's available on there. And spend some time with it. It really will be an inspiration. And just reading it will bring some realization. So, thank you. Any questions that you have? Yeah. The aspiration of Mahamudra or the aspiration to Mahamudra. They use different.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah. So far.
Well, I had a question. I kind of had this question for a while, but you brought up miracles.
Yeah.
So are miracles like magic, or are they something that we all can do if we become realized, or how do miracles fit into the Buddhist cosmology? This is a short question.
Well, I think, you know, it's to somebody who only knows arithmetic, somebody who can do calculus is a miracle worker. So, yeah, I think it's something that becomes part of any of us. It's all from our relative point of view that these things happen. It's why, like His Holiness Dalai Lama always says, I'm just an ordinary monk. And yet, when I've been around him, he's no ordinary monk to me, you know. But from his side, he's just doing the practice every day, you know, and he's just doing whatever he can skillfully to help people. So some of his skill would seem like a miracle to me, but for him, you know, for me, the addition and subtraction person, I don't think I'm even the long division in Dharma yet. Yeah, and when he does like calculus or something like that, I'm like amazed. And of course, he can solve a lot of problems from that level of insight, understanding, and skill. That's the way I understand it.
Okay. All right. I'll continue to think. Thank you.
Hi, Eric. Thank you for the teaching again.
Thanks for coming.
So how would you describe what the blessing is like? Since you said how important it is.
Can you speak a little louder for me?
How would you describe what the blessing is?
So,
color, shape, all those stuff.
Oh, blessing. Well, you know, to me, blessing, I don't think blessings necessarily have colors and shapes. I think it's more like when I'm in a sort of grabby, neurotic state of mind, I feel contracted. I feel tight, you know, I'm holding on. And when I feel a blessing, it's kind of like a warmth and an openness that is just a direct experience. So my heart, I think with my heart opening, I think just an open heart is a big blessing, is the big blessing. Since understanding the Dharma ultimately means getting out of that old hard shell that confines us, that holding on to some false sense of self, false identity. Those moments when my self concept, who I think I am, drops and I'm just open. That's what the blessing seems to me to be. And it's not conceptual. It's not something that has words or thoughts. The problem with words are they tend to be nouns, things, and blessings are not things. Even mind is not a thing, which is one of the problems with us trying to grasp this idea of a self. It's not a thing. It's more of a verb if you want to put a part of speech on it, because it's energy. So connect whatever connects me to the energy, the potentiality of enlightenment, and I catch a glimpse of that, feels like a blessing to me. Does that make sense?
Yes. Thank you, Eric.
Hi there. Thank you for your wonderful talk.
Thank you.
I don't have a question so much as just a quick recommendation for people that are interested in Rangdon Dorje.
Yeah.
I listen to a lot of podcasts.
And yeah.
A series of new books in Buddhist studies that's more like Western academic in nature.
Uh-huh.
I listened to an episode just recently about an author, Ruth Gamble, talking about her book, Reincarnation in Tibetan Buddhism, The Third Karmapa, and the Invention of a Tradition.
Right.
So it was really interesting, especially since she covers how he was the first third, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. He was the first person to ever be a line, essentially, of reincarnates versus just a one-off. So she's kind of talking about the whole toku system in this, as well as how it functioned politically at that time in Tibet.
Right.
Really fascinating.
Cool. Thanks. One thing to say about this idea of rebirth, technically it's probably not good to call it reincarnation, even though Western people do. That gives you some idea that there's some permanent soul or something that just changes hotel rooms every 80 years or so. Well, the room gets shabby after a while and you just want to check out, so you do. It's a little like that, but actually there's a certain flowing livingness. We call it mind stream, which is still not adequate. These nouns don't work for things that are beyond limitation, right? So if you can say it, it's not it. It's always a problem. But the thing to say about it is that, you know, there's this, in the Mahayana tradition of Buddhism, there's a thing called the Bodhisattva vow. And when you take that vow, what you're really saying is that you're placing the idea of interdependence, that we're all connected at the highest level. And therefore, it's not good enough just to achieve enlightenment and to be in nirvana in the spiritual country club where they're serving mimosas every morning. It's not like that. In fact, it's very unsatisfying to know that others are suffering. So the idea of being like Karmapa that comes back again and again is that they're here because of us. And to be part of his lineage in just hearing about him makes you in some way connected, is a sacred thing because you've become part of his activity, which is for your benefit, but also since this is a flow that comes to you, through blessing, we share in relieving the suffering of the world, and that's really what it's about. Buddhas are created by the union of wisdom, realization of wisdom, which is loving kindness and compassion. which is to be able to remove all suffering. And that's where also miracles come from. It's this profound, overwhelming, like, movement towards removing suffering. They're not just to make phenomenal events happen so everybody goes woo-woo. I suppose there is magical stuff like that that some people do, but in this tradition, that's not what it's about. So with that, let's dedicate the merit of being together this morning and hearing the Dharma and contemplating it. And let's dedicate the energy of this morning to practicing so that we too and all beings can pass beyond suffering and become Buddhas and benefit others without limit. Thank you. Oh, and remember, when you've grown to the point where you're uncomfortable, go on retreat, remove your shell, get more nutrients, grow a new shell, and come back out and do stuff.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.